morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be continuing the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Department of Human Services, talking about aging and people with disabilities. Ms. Byerly, anything you want to say to get us started?
Madam Co-Chair, just that in OLIS today, there is a presentation on this particular program that will be used in the next 2 days as the agency covers this program area.
Thank you very much. Ms. Carson Cottingham, Mr. Psyche, Ms. Brickman, anybody else coming up to join the party? Thank you very much. Lovely. Good morning, everybody.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. Thanks for having us back. We are happy to be here this morning to present on our aging and people with disabilities division. As we talked to you about yesterday or presented to you yesterday, this is an area where projections show an increase in the number of people we are going to be serving out into the future as the population ages. And we also are seeing some increase in the complexity of the issues that we're having to deal with in this population. And so presenting today will be our division director, Ashley Carson Cottingham. I appointed Ashley to this position in December of 2015. And in the very short time she's been the administrator, Ashley has made some very positive changes and displayed a high level of leadership and really has shifted the focus of the agency back to safety and to really put things in place that not only ensure safety but also ensure high quality of life for the people we serve. We're very lucky to have her, and she's also a lot of fun to work with. And so with that, I will turn the presentation over to Ashley.
Thank you, Director Psyche. Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Aging and People with Disabilities Director at the Department of Human Services. This next slide represents the presentation outline for the next 2 days. So today I'm going to cover our programmatic goals, our system, how to access services, and the parts of our program that cover adult protective services work and the licensure of the long-term care facilities. Tomorrow I'll get into detail around the Medicaid program and the other supports and services offered like Oregon Project Independence and Older Americans Act programs, as well as the efforts we've made around the sustainability, the long-term sustainability of the Medicaid program. The next slide represents our mission statement as for our program. This mission statement stems directly from ORS 410, which is the foundational statute for our program. And that statute states that older citizens of this state are entitled to enjoy their later years in health, honor, and dignity. And citizens with disabilities are entitled to live lives of maximum freedom and independence. The state of Oregon has been and continues to be a leader in long-term care. We were ranked number 3 in the nation by AARP and the SCAN Foundation. And in 1981, Oregon received the first waiver nationwide so that we could provide long-term care outside of nursing facilities and in community-based settings. Oregon is also ranked number 1 at effective transitions from nursing facilities or institutional settings into the community or into people's homes. We're really proud of that. So the next slide represents our programmatic goals. We went through a process over the last couple of years to reaffirm goals. We added a goal. And we also looked at our quarterly business review process and tried to align our goals to the metrics that we were going to be looking at through that process. This will help our program to understand where we have gaps, where we're making progress towards achieving those goals. As you know, the population is aging, and we hear about it quite frequently in the media. And for that reason, Oregon has been really forward-thinking about our approach to the Aging and People with Disabilities programs. In Oregon, the 65-plus population is projected to grow from 645,000 in 2015 to more than 1 million by 2030, and then up to 1.3 million by 2050. It's important to note the potential impact of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. The risk of developing Alzheimer's and other dementias rises with advanced age. And so we need to collectively be thinking about how we're going to care for our aging population. The disability population is also growing. From national data, we know that the number of individuals in the U.S. receiving Social Security disability insurance grew from 6.5 million in 2005 up to 8 million in 2015. We're also concerned about the crisis that we hear about in retirement savings. This has the potential to impact our Medicaid long-term care program over time. When people need long-term care, they quickly realize that it is very expensive and they may not have enough savings to cover the full cost of long-term care for very many years. And we know that during the economic downturn, a lot of the boomers and people just before turning 65 lost retirement savings, lost jobs, lost other assets. And so that has an impact when they look at their ability to retire and pay for long-term care. Another interesting thing to note is that the number of people who are...
I'm sorry, Ms. Carson, can I
Hey, sorry.
Representative Lanzalian.
Thank you, Chair. Can you go back to the prior slide, please? So I think I can speak for myself, but we like sometimes a demographic breakdown. Here in this particular slide, you talk about the aging population increasing, right? Do you guys have a breakdown of the demographics within the elder population here? Do you guys have that information? Because that will help me understand how you're serving everybody statewide.
Co-chairs, Representative Alonzo Leon, when you say demographics, what specifically do you mean? We have it broken down by age demographics here, but
right.
Are you looking for race, ethnicity, yes. Other demographics?
Yes.
I don't have that today for you, but we could certainly look into it and provide it back to the committee.
Perfect.
Because I think that is very important.
Thank you. It'd be very helpful. Thank you, Representative. Please.
So another interesting thing to note is that people 60 plus have quite a bit of student loan debt that they are still dealing with. And there's been a dramatic increase in that amount of debt for the 60 plus population. And so I just want to bring that to the committee's attention because it does have the potential to impact over time. The average amount of debt that a 60-plus person has is around $23,000 nationally. Medicaid is required to pay for nursing home level of care if you meet financial eligibility and service eligibility. And seniors and adults with disabilities are oftentimes, when they need long-term care, they're spending down their resources and then coming on to the Medicaid long-term care program. APD uses a social model of services. I'm going to briefly touch on all of our services and then get into greater detail, as I had said in the beginning, tomorrow. Our approach is that there's no wrong door. We start with a holistic assessment of the person when they come to us. We move on to service planning, and throughout the whole process, we value a person's choice, dignity, and self-direction. We balance all of that after those conversations with the person's natural supports, people in their life that can help them with some of the activities of daily living or other things so that they can remain independent. And after that conversation's been had, then we talk about the services and supports that we have available to help somebody. This slide shows the array of services we offer, and the numbers represent the individuals that we serve. We assist a diverse population of older adults and people with disabilities to achieve well-being through opportunities for community living, employment, family support, and long-term services and supports.
Ms. Carson Cunningham, before you go off the slide, I have a question for you. I'm looking at this and I'm trying to figure out, are these numbers potentially overlapping, or if you add them all up, does this represent how many people you all touch in the state?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, there could be someone served in multiple programs. So these are individuals being served, but it's safe to say that someone might receive Older Americans Act Meals on Wheels, and also an Oregon Project Independence Service, or they would have come to us for Medicaid and received financial eligibility determinations, and then they are on that caseload for receiving home services.
So I will admit that I didn't do what I try to do, which is preview your slides last night. But do you have a slide somewhere down here that breaks us down so we understand a little bit more how many Oregonians altogether your division is touching?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'm not sure that I have that particular slide, but I could work on that and bring the total number when I start my presentation tomorrow.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you. Just to get some sense, I mean, if you look at that number of a million people in 2025 or whatever we're at now.
And you're looking at unique individuals served.
Yes.
So the people that would be served in multiple programs would only be counted as one.
Right. Exactly. Okay. And it's probably, it's more than I would ask you to do by tomorrow. But it might be helpful to have some sense, once you figure out how many unique individuals there are, you know, how many of them are getting just one of these and how many are getting three or more or something like that. Because I think it gives us some sense of the range of need in the community as we start to look at it, and it gives us some sense of what those percentages might look like down the road as our population ages.
Okay, we'd be happy to work on that, and we'll do our best, but it might take a little more drilling down.
Absolutely. So I don't expect an answer even this week.
Thank you.
I would just like an answer by phase two. How about that for a deal?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, moving on. So this slide represents the laws that were passed in 1965. This was sort of the national vision back then. And in July, President Johnson signed three landmark pieces of legislation that shaped the lives of older Americans in our country. That was Medicare, Medicaid, and the Older Americans Act. Medicare and Medicaid, as I'm sure you're aware, extended health insurance to vulnerable people. And the Older Americans Act was designed to be sort of a light touch set of services that could help someone remain independent. And you could have your Medicaid or Medicare coverage for primary health insurance coverage, but also receive those home-delivered meals or congregate meals at a senior center to help you remain independent for longer and not have to move on to the more expensive Medicaid long-term care program. So prior to the passage of this suite of laws, older adults often struggled with access to appropriate medical care and access to long-term care. At APD, or Aging and People with Disabilities, we're committed to this vision. We want to get people what they need in the least intrusive way possible, but the things that can keep them independent for longer without having to come onto the Medicaid program. This map represents where the Aging and People with Disabilities offices and the area agencies on aging offices are located across the state. There are 16 districts for the purposes of Medicaid and Adult Protective Services work, 12 state offices, and 4 aging area agencies on aging. Our system is a partnership between the state offices and the area agencies on aging. Aging and People with Disabilities, our office, generally sets the policy and regulates the entire system, and services are carried out through a combination of our state offices and the area agencies on aging. APD state offices also do they do Medicaid, and they do the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Programs, or SNAP, food stamps, for our populations. And we partner with other area agencies on aging to provide the Older Americans Act services and the Oregon Project Independence services. The Aging Services Network designates an area agency on aging for each part of the state. So in everyone's area, you will have an area agency on aging that's designated for that service and planning area. And that's set out in the Federal Older Americans Act. In Oregon, it's unique because we have a law that allows for area agencies on aging to sort of take over, if you will, the function of a state office in a particular area if they have the resources and they want to do that. So in Oregon, we have four area agencies on aging who have chosen to do that and have taken over that function of the state office. And in the previous slide, those are in the shaded areas along the I-5 corridor. Everywhere else in the state, if you wanted Medicaid or SNAP, you would be going to the state office, and if you were interested in Older Americans Act or Oregon Project Independence services, you would go to the local area agency on aging. So now that I've given you a lot of information, I know that it's really confusing how Oregonians are expected to access the services they need, and we're talking oftentimes about vulnerable people. So I want to draw your attention to the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. Recognizing the confusion in Oregon and nationally about how to access aging and disability services, the Fed started a movement around aging and disability resource centers being created. And in Oregon, our model is the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. So this is a way for you, a loved one, a constituent, they call this number and they go through an options counseling process no matter what the need is. If you need just a little bit of support for yourself or your mom, you're interested in a home-delivered meal for your grandma, you call and are walked through an options counseling process. And it's also for people who are in poverty or people who have lots of means, and they walk through the full array of aging and disability services and direct you to the appropriate physical location to receive that service.
Sorry,
I just had a quick question on this. In terms of staffing, are you adequately staffed? What's the response time? I know I've heard various things on that, and I'm just kind of curious what your opinion is of how well the program's working.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, we are staffed. I'm going to have to look to Eric. I think at about 80. Some percent of our workload model for our case managers. We just recently implemented a workload model for our adult protective services workers. I would say there's always, we could always use more staff. With the aging demographics that we're looking at. I think that we try to adopt lean processes and do as much as we can with the staff that we're given by the legislature. But I think we need to be forward thinking and figuring out what we might need moving forward.
Yeah, I'd just be one quick follow up. What is the wait time and then the call volume in a given, I don't know if you look at it per week, per month, or quarter?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield. I think tomorrow I'll get into some of the aggregate data around number of calls to the ADRC specifically, and I can talk about the adult protective services work where we have specific timeframes set out in statute, and we respond within those timeframes. Yeah. But I don't know the answer to the wait time if you're calling the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. But I can try to find that out for you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how many people are calling, what's the wait time, stuff like that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yes. So kind of along the lines that Representative Rayfield mentioned, how can you give me kind of an example, or maybe you'll cover this tomorrow, but how do you promote this service to our non-English speaking population? Send them, material via, snail mail? And how do you know they're receiving that information, or how does one know that these services exist?
Co-chairs, Representative Alonso Leon, that's a very good question. I believe that a lot of the materials for the Aging and Disability Resource Connection are translated into other languages, but I want to be 100% sure, so I will look into that and provide you with a response. As far as getting the information out across the state, we do a lot of tabling at various community events, and we are specifically looking at increasing our outreach to diverse populations to make sure that this information is getting to people who've been historically underserved. And so our some of our staff that work on service equity are mapping out exactly what we think we should be doing, but we're not just going to go with that plan. We're then going to meet with communities that have been underserved and ask them if they think this will meet their needs before we implement the plan.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Now I'm going to turn to the various programs that we have. First, I'm going to start with our Adult Protective Services. As Director Psyche mentioned yesterday, our agency has been very focused on safety of vulnerable populations, and not just for children, but for older adults and people with disabilities as well. The Aging and People with Disabilities offices and certain area agencies on aging across the state are responsible for adult protective services work. And they have excellent staff who are trained and ready to get out and respond to allegations of abuse. We conduct the investigations in people's homes and in licensed long-term care settings. The list on the slide represents the types of abuse articulated in Oregon law. We investigate the allegations to determine whether or not wrongdoing occurred. And for facility-based investigations, the licensing or corrective action team at our licensing program looks at those abuse findings and then assesses penalties associated with that abuse. We work to protect people statewide, putting appropriate interventions in place and working closely with law enforcement when needed. And I want to draw your attention to the abuse reporting line that's up there in the red box. This is the best way to call and report abuse and have our investigators get out and start investigating that allegation in a timely fashion. We have about, in a year's time, 1,000 facility abuses, so 1,000 times that we investigate many more times than that, but 1,000 that are confirmed to have been elder or adult abuse in the facility-based settings, and about 3,800 that are confirmed or substantiated as abuse in community cases.
Senator Gelser. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you substantiate an abuse in a facility, what tools do you have to protect individuals in that facility from either being personally re-abused or having the same abuse occur again by the same facility?
Co-chairs, Senator Gelser, we have a variety of tools. We start first with the with looking at what occurred and how severe the abuse was, and then we assess a civil penalty. And the facility then is required to pay that civil penalty, and if it looks like there is, if the abuse is very serious, we might also do a condition on their license, or If there have been multiple instances of abuse, we would probably likely move to doing a condition on the license. And a condition, I'll get into a little more detail in a few minutes here, but it might require training for all of the staff. You know, if what was happening was neglect, we would want there to be potentially an RN consultant go in and do a little more hands-on work with the direct caregivers to make sure they understand what their responsibilities are. And during that time when the training's occurring, we would often restrict admissions to the facility until they can demonstrate that they've fixed the underlying problem so that no more people are abused.
Can you follow up, please? Thank you. So recently in the news, there have been a number of stories of very large for-profit provider organizations that have had some pretty egregious cases of abuse. Do you have the appropriate tools, and is the fine and civil penalty structure sufficient to deter that type of repeated behavior?
Co-chairs, Senator Gelser, I think as a program we have quite a few tools to try to change behavior. The fines that we assess for certain abuses are fairly low. They have not been changed or updated since the 70s. And I'm not certain that they deter the bad behavior. We don't have a huge, there's about 9% of, if you look over 3 years at our community-based care, about 9% of those facilities have instances of repeat abuse. And, you know, that's a fairly low number, but it's still a lot of abuse. So I think, you know, we're interested in a conversation about how we can drive the numbers down to zero and really work with the providers to make sure that people aren't abused in long-term care.
And one more follow-up?
Please.
Have you ever had a provider say, gosh, it's too hard to fix this, it's just easier to pay the penalty?
Co-chairs, Senator Gelser, I personally have not heard a provider say that. I just know what I see in the reports and what the data shows. And I think if you look at that same three-year period, we've got 50% of our facilities that have a civil penalty assessed. So, you know, that seems like a fairly high number of instances where we're assessing a penalty for abuse or a rule violation that resulted in harm. So I'd really like to work to figure out how we can support the providers, do more training, you know, have our staff work collaboratively and ensure that abuse isn't occurring, harm isn't occurring to long-term care residents.
So Co-Chair Steiner here and Co-Chair Riffield and Senator Gelser, you know, there are a lot of parallels I think you can draw to some of the issues we're working in child welfare. And I just wanted to say, you know, once again, if you look across the spectrum, a large number of the providers really provide excellent care and are very committed to the people they care for. But we do have issues that we need to deal with because, you know, as Ashley and I look at some of the reports that come in and some of the incidents that happen, I mean, they really are things that kind of keep you up at night and cause me a great deal of worry. And kind of the standard we have been applying is, would we want our mom or dad to be subjected to that kind of an environment or that kind of treatment?
And Madam Chair, I think that's true. And I know the vast majority of providers that provide services for all vulnerable people of any age or any need in for the DHS population are extraordinary, working under very difficult circumstances for not very much money. And we do have some problems, and every one
Absolutely.
Of those is too many. And I've appreciated the focus on safety, the letters that we get from you, Ashley, about licensing actions. And I think it's just important as a culture that the department sees licensing as a consumer protection entity for seniors and people with disabilities and children rather than a support system for providers. That doesn't mean being unsupportive of providers or not providing yeah. information, but the primary focus, I hope, of the agency and the department is that the consumer, the focus is the individual, and the providers are contractors that from whom you are purchasing a service, and you are appropriate to have a high degree of expectation, enforcement of licensing standards, and the expectation that abuse not occur.
Right.
Ms. Carson Cottingham, are you going to be talking a little bit more about your licensure process and your investigation process over the next day or two?
Yes, in just a few minutes, actually.
Great, then I'll hold my question until we get there. Thank you.
Okay, next slide. This slide just represents the APS, or Adult Protective Services offices, receive a lot of different calls, and not all of them result in a substantiated instance of adult or elder abuse. Our staff, alongside with the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, are working to do public education around abuse, case consultation and technical assistance, training, research and data analysis of what we're seeing. They advise people in the whole agency and outside of the agency on policy around adult and elder abuse. And then we're also always maintaining our national partnerships with organizations across the country that work on adult abuse. In the community, for those 1,000 facility-based substantiations, the top three types of abuse that are substantiated are neglect, financial exploitation, and physical abuse. And in the community, it's financial exploitation, verbal or emotional abuse, which also usually comes hand in hand with that financial exploitation, and neglect. Community abuse investigations are the ones that we conduct in somebody's home or family home outside of a licensed long-term care setting. These, as you can see, these allegations have increased pretty dramatically since 2011. And in looking at that increase, we think that this is likely due to to all of the increased education that's occurred around elder abuse. People are much more aware that this is a real thing impacting our older adults and people with disabilities, and we're getting more and more reports. Not all of those end up being substantiated abuse, but we're hearing more about it, and we also have a larger number of older people in the state.
Ms. Carson Cottingham, I'm really glad that people are getting educated about this and calling in. I'm a little worried that some of the economic issues that you alluded to very early in your presentation may also be exacerbating that. If family members feel more of a strain caring for older folks, do you have any sense of whether the economics of the aging population is that a predisposing factor for an increased likelihood of abuse or neglect, or is it independent of economic circumstances?
Co-Chair Rafio, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I don't have research here today that can back exactly what you're saying, but I think that it likely exists, and so I'd like to drill into that a little more and bring something back. I think the economics of an aging population play into a lot of what's going on, and just the sheer numbers of older adults that we have, and the strain on younger people with student loan debt, or, you know, there's all kinds of family dynamics and economics that come into play when we look at a family who or a person who's experienced financial exploitation.
Thank you. Appreciate mm-hmm. that.
For facility abuse, the investigations show us that the percent of Oregonians experiencing abuse in long-term care is around 2.5%. This equates to about 1,000 people in a year's time that experience one form of adult or elder abuse. In memory care, the percent is almost double that, around 4.5%, and we don't yet know the root cause of why it's so much higher in memory care. But this is an example of a data point that is now on our quarterly business review, and something that I'm watching very closely and asking our staff to drill down and figure out why is it that there's a higher likelihood of experiencing abuse in memory care than other setting types. And of course, our ultimate goal is that we would be driving that that 2% down to zero over time. Our systems for our adult protective services work are very outdated. We have no way to track screening data. So the calls that we're getting at the the calls come in at the local level, and we don't have a good statewide mechanism for capturing what's being screened in and screened out. And the system that we use for report writing is outdated, sometimes stops working. And I learned last night that it was actually created in a cubicle at our human services building on a Microsoft Access database about 20 years ago. And so that's what we're still using to do our adult abuse reports. It doesn't have a very strong query mechanism, so when I'm trying to figure out what's going on or look at trends, it's just not very doable with the systems we have. So for the past several years, we've been working towards implementing a centralized abuse management system. We've presented on this system to the legislature before, and we now have our system integrator Vertiba on board, and we are utilizing a Salesforce platform. It's a cloud-based solution, and it will be used across the Aging and People with Disabilities and the Office of Developmental Disability Services to track screening and do report writing around abuse. This is a transfer solution from Colorado, so it's a tested system. It's working for that state. People went out to Colorado to see how their adult protective services workers are using it, and four states were interested in transferring that solution, and the federal government also thinks that it's a good model. And so Colorado shared the code, the underlying code, for the Salesforce platform with the four states, and all of us are looking to implement that. The project's underway. The pilot will likely start towards the end of this year, and we'll have the system statewide probably sometime in the middle of next year.
So one of the questions, and I know we're going to get into the whole one eligibility system separately, but one of the questions about that one is how much customization we're having to do of the Kentucky system to transfer it over to Oregon. Is it your sense that we're going to be able to use the Colorado solution pretty close intact, or are we going to have to do a lot of customization on it?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, we have to do minimal customization. Okay. There are some things that are sort of the musts for the Oregon way, but we're also looking at our business process to make sure that we're adapting our business process, because when you do a transfer solution, you don't want to have to change the technology too much.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. You change the business practices, you don't change the technology.
Yeah, I think we're definitely looking at changing business process, and there will be some changes to the Colorado solution, but we are trying to keep those to a minimum.
Thank you.
So for the first time, once this is implemented, we'll be able to look across the system statewide, know what's being screened in and screened out. We'll be able to have better quality assurance and know where our training gaps are, where we need to really support the workers to ensure that they understand that, you know, this particular abuse should have been screened in or that one should have been screened out, and look at reports in real time and know that the language they're using, wasn't as helpful as it could have been to law enforcement, or we can pull out reports that are an ideal report and use those as a model. It'll just give us really those modern tools to better manage the adult protective services work. We do have a POP for about $4.3 million.
Sorry, Representative Alonso Leon. Oh, sorry, you just got inspired by a new question. So having worked for the state in my previous position, I always look at the importance of updating, upgrading technical systems, right? Mm-hmm. And being able to, the concept of centralizing information is also, are we using a separate system for this department, a separate system for this other department, and they're not talking to each other mm-hmm. when they should? And then we realize we should have bought one system that can work across all the different state agencies. so that we can get the most information. So, I, and you may be presenting on this on the future presentation related to our foster youth and how they how abuse is reported. Is this specific system just for our aging and disabilities population, and then you have a different system for our foster parents and mm-hmm. and issues related to child abuse and whatnot?
Co-chairs, Representative Alonzo Leon, this system is specific to adult abuse, but it is across multiple programs. So in the first iteration or first phase, I guess, it will be the Aging and People with Disabilities program and our Office of Developmental Disability Services program. Also in the scope of the total project is the mental health abuse investigations in, and you know, mental health is in the Oregon Health Authority. And so those are all sort of what the project originally was scoped to be. It will not include to my knowledge, the foster youth data.
So there's a different system that captures that? I'm sorry, follow up.
All good.
So Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonzo Leon, there is. We have a system called ORCIDS, which is our case management and data system for the child welfare program.
We'll look forward to hearing more about that from Ms. Al-Husseini when she's here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We have a POP that's put forward in the governor's recommended budget for $4.3 million, and that will support this project and IT solution moving forward and being rolled out and implemented ongoing. Next, I'll turn to the facility licensing portion of our work at Aging and People with Disabilities. Through our Safety Oversight and Quality Unit, we are responsible for licensure of nursing facilities, residential care, assisted living, memory care communities, and adult foster homes. Oregon was a pioneer in developing models like assisted living and adult foster homes so that Oregonians would have alternatives to being served in an institution or nursing home setting. We continue to have many providers, as we talked about earlier, that are innovative, dedicated, compassionate, and care just wonderfully for some of our most vulnerable people. I think we all collectively want to see high quality in our licensed long-term care settings. And from some of the research that I've looked at, you can only have high quality when you know that there's consumer satisfaction, there's employee satisfaction, the people in the facilities providing that care. You have stability of the workforce within those facilities. You have positive or good outcomes for the people receiving long-term care and and positive regulatory performance overall. These are the approximate numbers on the slide of the numbers of facilities that are licensed in Oregon broken down by type. So you can see we have 137 nursing facilities, 518 assisted living and residential care facilities, and 1,600 or so adult foster homes. Memory care in our state is an endorsement that you receive on top of the underlying licensure. So the other column represents how many memory care endorsed settings there are broken down by what the underlying licensure is. And we have seen a lot of growth in the assisted living and residential care industry. And if providers want to participate in Medicaid, we have a unit within Aging and People with Disabilities that enrolls the providers according to Medicaid law and our state requirements. This unit confirms the provider qualifications and any exclusion status prior to enrolling them as a Medicaid provider. The majority of our providers participate in Medicaid. We have about 73% of the foster home providers that participate. 84% of the assisted living and residential care facilities participate in Medicaid, and 90% of our nursing facilities. In Oregon, long-term care providers pay fees to be licensed by the state, and the fees are deposited into the long-term care quality fund. The quality fund then is used to improve quality training, technical assistance, quality improvement for providers, and other licensing activities so that we can ensure there's high quality in long-term care.
So let me clarify what you just said. The facilities pay the fees, and I don't know if those are bed-based or whatever, but they pay fees, but they don't actually go toward the inspections and investigations and everything that are actually part of the licensing. They go to a separate fund that is in part related to licensure, but is in part related to other initiatives.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, yes, that's correct.
So who pays for the actual work of the licensing and investigations unit?
We receive an appropriation from the legislature. There's about $10 million in general fund that we utilize to support the licensing function.
So other businesses that are licensed, whether it's a restaurant or pretty much any other business, their licensing fee supports the work of the licensing agency. And professionals who are licensed in this state, some of whom sit on this board, on this committee, our licensure fees support the work of the agency that licenses us. But in your world, licensing fees don't actually support the work of the licensing, the general fund does.
Yes, that is correct.
Do we have a sense of why that is? Because it seems unusual to me.
I know that in Oregon it's been this way for a long time, and that there are some schools of thought that this is, you know, an investment that the state makes to protect vulnerable people. The fees, you know, are not, they're based, they're in law, they're in statute, and you would pay more depending on how many beds you have if you're a nursing facility or assisted living facility. And for adult foster homes, it is a per bed flat fee of $20 per bed annually.
But by the argument of protecting vulnerable Oregonians, when the nursing board, the dental board, or the medical board is licensing people, part of their mission, and they state them explicitly, is to protect Oregonians. So by that argument, my licensure fee should be paid for by the general fund also. Okay.
That's a lot of policy for a budget committee, right?
Well, I'm just saying, I don't quite get it, because the corporations division having sat in this room and chaired General Gov for 4 years, I know the corporations division, the fees that businesses pay to get licensed support the work of that division. They're not high, but they support the work of the division. So I'm confused.
And just being on the natural resources sub, there are some agencies that, you know, we do subsidize the licensing. And so I would be interesting to know what the original rationale for why we actually subsidize the licensing. I mean, because I don't know. The other thing that I think would be interesting would be, how much do we get currently in our fees that come into the fund or for the licensing that go into that quality fund?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, I'm going to have to look up the total amount. I think it's around $2 million, but I don't know that that's exactly accurate. So I have it here somewhere in my binder, and I will try to find it for you before we close today. And if I can't, then I will bring back the amount total in a biennium that the fees pay into the quality fund or the.
And then the last follow-up, which is, and I know that the civil penalties also go in there, and I was curious how much money of the civil penalties go into the fund in terms of amount.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, the full amount of the civil penalties and the fees goes into the long-term care quality fund. And what I can tell you is that right now there's about $3.4 million sitting in the quality fund. About close to $800,000 of that is obligated. We've already granted that money out to entities that are doing quality projects, quality improvement projects, and the remainder is ready to be allocated to projects. We're about to put an RFP out the door for a small grants program so that providers could apply to the department to do something in their facility or a couple of facilities that would improve quality, and then a quality fund board will determine who to grant that money to. We also have a second phase of a project that we did around acuity-based staffing that some contractors developed a tool, some algorithms in Excel as the first phase. And there's been a lot of talk around it needing that tool being converted into something that's a lot more user-friendly, web-based type of a tool. And so we'd like to use some of that money to create that tool. The legislature did put a $1 million fund limitation. So we are only allowed, I believe, at this point to spend $1 million of what's in there annually. And like I said, we have about $800,000 obligated right now.
Ms. Carson Cottingham, when you come back with the information that Representative Rayfield asked for, would you also please come back with details about how much your licensing division's work costs, specifically, and sort of break some of the breakdown of those costs, and then what you would do if you had that amount, that general fund amount, liberated, and how it might be better used to serve the people who are currently being helped by it?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I can tell you how much total funds are used for the licensing function right now, if you'd like.
I'd love that.
So the general fund amount that we utilize is $10 million a biennium, and we're able to match that at the admin rate, and so we receive around $21 million total funds to support the staff in that unit. We have about 12... I believe it's 12 licensors that cover the 518 assisted living and residential care facilities. We have 40-some licensors that support the nursing facilities. And those positions that do the licensing in the nursing facility arena are subsidized at a higher rate from the federal government because there are so many requirements from CMS around how the survey or inspection is done in a nursing facility. So we have a lot more staff covering fewer nursing homes, but there are also a lot more requirements.
Okay. We should probably have another conversation about what you might be able to do with that $10 million if it were diverted into other work of your division to support the services to the older and disabled Oregonians that you serve. So, and whether there's a better federal match rate we could get or anything like that. So we should probably have more of a conversation about that. Coach Rayfield?
Yeah. And so there's 40 people licensing the 137 nursing facilities and then 11 people licensing and reviewing the assisted living and residential care facilities. How many people are reviewing the adult foster homes, or do we have people doing that? Because there's 1,600 of those.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, I misspoke. We have 16 surveyors for the community-based care or assisted living residential care, 38 for the nursing facilities, and also 38 statewide for the adult foster home licensure. The 38 licensors for adult foster homes are spread out across the state in local offices and in those counties that have taken over the function of a state office. But yes, it's not very many licensors for many homes. They are required to do an annual inspection of the foster home and also do other visits when issues arise around safety or complaints around quality of care.
Yeah, it's, it, well, in terms of, I haven't gotten my iPhone calculator out yet, but I'm just kind of curious, 38 to 1,600 adult foster homes, I mean, and you're doing annual inspections. What's the success rate of completing all of the annual inspections and being responsive to all the complaints in all the homes?
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, I will have to bring that back to you. I have not heard that we are missing the mark on our annual inspections in that arena, but it doesn't mean that, I think some of our data issues also exist in the adult foster home program in particular, and we are also rolling out a statewide system called Aspen for those licensors, so they will be able to go into the homes with a laptop and do the licensing function, and it will be the data then will be uploaded to a database that I will be able to look across and know and have better metrics about what's occurring out in the field. Right now, a lot of that is paper-based, and when we need to understand what's happening in a local office, they have to sort of send all that paper up. It's very antiquated, and so I'm hoping once Aspen is rolled out completely statewide, I think it's been rolled out in a couple areas so far, and they're doing active training to roll it out, we'll really have a better sense of where our gaps are in that program.
And then one last follow-up.
Please, and Representative Malmstrom.
Yeah, it'd be helpful to kind of, I guess, see that data for all of the different categories. And and then the other thing is, you know, obviously from a workload standpoint, when people are overworked, you tend to do what you need to do to meet the requirements. And so sometimes quality can be... not as emphasized as much when you're trying to meet certain deadlines, right? Because you have certain requirements that you're being graded upon in an employment status. And so it'd be interesting to see just kind of, you know, your opinion on that and kind of what you would actually need to feel as though you're doing the work to the standard that you would like the work to be done.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield. So with respect to the time frames for the people doing, for those 16 surveyors, I know that for residential care and assisted living facilities, we're required to do the annual or the inspection every other year. So once every 24 months in that bucket of facilities. In talking with our staff, it looks like our average is about every 29 months. So we are not meeting our time frame of 24 months with that number of staff right now. Okay. To deal with that, the team is looking at their process, trying to go through kind of a lean exercise to figure out what kind of pre-work can be done before you go out to the facility, and you know, maximizing the time when they are in the facility. So they're really looking at the process and pulling it apart and putting it back together in a way that we hope will be more streamlined and help us to meet our time frames more efficiently. For nursing facilities, I believe we're federally mandated to go every year. And if you get out of compliance by 13 or 14 months, that can be really serious for the state. And so I think we're always really driving to meet those timeframes, but I'll get you the specific data around where we stand today with the nursing facility surveys.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank
you. Sorry, Representative Malmstrom, I apologize.
Thank you, chairs, co-chairs. This is kind of a generalized question, but I'm hearing a lot of words like surveying and lots about complaints and time frames and all those things. But I'm thinking, as a nurse, I'm thinking more of assessment. And I'm wondering, and maybe you're going to cover this later, but when you're doing a license, is there really an assessment of needs versus just looking for complaints? Because those are two very different kinds of things. Can you address that a little bit, please? Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Malmstrom. The survey process, as I understand it, and I'm by no means the expert, they go through a lot of different issues when they're in the facility. They'll look at physical plant. They'll look at care planning for residents. They'll pull a sample of I don't know what the sample size has to be, but different residents' care plans. They will look at medication charts and document if something is off. And if they're not doing it appropriately based on that sample of residents, they get a tag, and then they have to provide a plan of correction around that deficiency, essentially. So they are looking at the people in the facility and whether their needs are being met. Sometimes it's really difficult to know, you know, is the facility staffed to meet all of the needs of all of the residents? I think that's a question that all of us wrestle with frequently. And so that tool I mentioned earlier that came from the Quality Fund money that was developed is a tool that's designed to be able to enter in each resident, what their needs are, the frequency of any of their ADL needs or activity of daily living needs, and then out would pop a number of staff that would be required to meet those needs. I know that many of the larger facilities have excellent tools to help them know how many staff they need to have on at any given time, but there's also facilities that struggle with knowing exactly how many. It really is the facility's responsibility to staff to meet the planned and unplanned needs of residents, and that's what we're trying to hold them accountable to. But, you know, we're committed to making a tool widely available for their use that would help determine whether there are enough people there to meet the people's needs.
Okay, follow up.
Please.
But the reason I ask the question is I've had a lot of nurse colleagues tell stories about, you know, everything is kind of complaint driven, and those people that complain or their families that are there to complain, they get different level service than those who have no family or the client is not, you know, cognizant enough to know what they're not getting. And I just worry about who's advocating for those people and how that might be showing up in, you know, your licensing and assessment. So that's why I asked the question.
Co-chairs, Representative Malmstrom, thank you for bringing up that point. That's something that's really important to me, and I believe that our agency is responsible for speaking on behalf of the people that don't have the advocate, as well as the people that have an advocate, and that quality should be the same across the board, that our private pay consumers, our Medicaid consumers, people with family, people without family, all deserve a really high level of care and quality in long-term care. And we work really closely with the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, too, because his office has people out in the facilities, volunteers who can also talk with people who may be underrepresented. They're bringing things to our attention frequently. So some of the complaints are driven by that advocacy work that the Ombudsman Office does. But we are also trying to cross-train our staff so that when a case manager goes into a facility to work with that Medicaid consumer, that's not their only job. They're part of our bigger agency, and they need to be sort of doing the scan, thinking about, is something else off in this facility? And then getting the other staff that are trained to do that licensing or protective services work out there. And so that we're in communication, we're collaborating, we're working with the provider, and everybody knows what the expectations are.
Thank you.
And as a reminder to the committee, we'll be hearing from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman on Monday.
Yes. So moving on to compliance tools in long-term care, we have this list of tools. It is a pretty broad set of tools that we have at our disposal. And our approach as an agency is really a progressive one. We do not want to go into the facility the first time that there's a problem with a really heavy hand. Our long-term care providers are important to the system, dedicated to serving a growing number of older adults and people with disabilities, and we want to make sure that they have the tools necessary to provide that high quality of care. The last thing we really want to have to do is go in and revoke a license or immediately suspend operation in a long-term care setting. That can be extremely disruptive to vulnerable people. There's a real thing that is called transfer trauma. And when you're already vulnerable or have dementia and you have to move from where you live to somewhere else, it can be incredibly traumatic. And so we want to minimize when we're doing that. But we also are not afraid to hold providers accountable when we see that there's a major health, safety, and welfare issue in the facility. We created a new team within our safety, oversight, and quality unit of compliance specialists. And my charge to them is that they are the ones that need to be responsive to complaints that are not abuse-related, but complaints that arise about quality or other licensing issues. And they need to be able to go out, get to know the providers in their regions, and work with the provider to help them come into compliance. So the goal of this team is to really provide the lighter touch, early on support so that the provider understands that they're getting close to potentially violating a rule or, you know, kind of dealing with that smoke before the fire. So that's really what their charge is from me. I want them to get to know the owners, the operators, the staff, and so they feel comfortable seeking that technical assistance when this particular part of our agency goes into that facility. Then we have our surveys, which are the formal process of inspection, and there are different time frames based on setting type, and we've already kind of covered that. If there are major problems, rule violations, or abuse that occurs, we have the ability to levy the civil penalties. If a survey shows us that there is a lot of noncompliance, a lot of deficiencies, and or we have abuse occurring, we have the ability to impose a licensing condition. A condition could be a restriction of admissions until they've demonstrated that they can come back into compliance. It could be a mandated RN for 20 hours a week to be in the facility to work with the staff. It could be full-on requiring a full-on management company to come in and rework the way that they are managing the facility for a particular amount of time. Or it could be that we work with the facility to say, we've been out here many, many times, we've had other conditions imposed, but you really are still not in compliance, and we need a management company to take over the full operations of this facility. We can also move to suspend, revoke, or non-renew a license. And we can have a department-approved consultant go in to work with the facility. I'll show you a little bit of data around the numbers of civil penalties that have been imposed. We have two types of civil penalties that we can use according to law. There are base fines, and then there are also separate penalties called enhanced civil penalties for cases of serious injury, sexual abuse, rape, or death. And serious injury applies in the cases of disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or loss or impairment of an organ. So this chart just represents the numbers of penalties that we assessed in 2015 and 2016. I'll point out that the 2016 civil penalties might go up because of complaints or abuses that occurred at the end of last year, and they're still working their way through the finalization process of the report. For conditions, these are the numbers of conditions that we imposed in 2015 and 2016, broken out by setting type. We hadn't been very good in the past about using our full regulatory authority, and that was pointed out to us last session, and so we were focused on making sure that when it's warranted, we are using our full authority under law. And the imposition of conditions has proved to be an effective tool in helping the facility get back into substantial compliance. With nursing facilities, we cannot impose conditions. We can do a restriction of admissions if warranted, but the feds or CMS have their own penalty structure that they used to enforce compliance. Well, these numbers have gone up quite a bit. I want to point out that it's a relatively small number of facilities that we have had to place a condition on. For example, the 28 of is out of the 518 that I referenced earlier, facilities in community-based care. So that basically we've only had to impose conditions on 5% of that that chunk of our provider community. We've received some feedback from the industry that we need to be clearer about why we might impose a condition, what are the factors leading up to when we impose a condition, and what is the expectation for removing the condition. For example, if they've done all the things we've asked, how quickly is the agency going to get back out there to kind of do that final check and lift the condition? And I think those are fair questions. We're working to get that written into a policy, but I think it's a fair expectation that they would know when they have fixed all the issues how quickly we're going to get back in there. That is a resources issue for us, but I think we're committed to wanting to lift a restriction of admissions, for example, as soon as possible, because that has detrimental impact to the community, to hospitals, when they can't discharge people back to a facility or place someone in a facility. It can be taxing for a community, especially in some of our rural or coastal communities.
This is your next one's your last slide, so it'd be great if you could book through that one and we're done and get you for today, right?
Yes.
Cool.
I've got a lot of questions.
Yeah, you don't get to ask any more questions today. No more questions. Everybody has to hold questions for tomorrow.
Moving on to immediate suspensions. Immediate suspensions are a tool that we've used quite a bit in our adult foster home program. When I came on board as the director, we had a lot of work to do in our adult foster home licensing program. We've worked really hard to put mechanisms in place to make sure that our field licensors that I talked about earlier, the ones that sit out across the state, are working collaboratively with the central office staff, and that things aren't falling between the cracks. We also have a new position called safety liaisons that help bridge that gap to make sure that there are no miscommunications from what the people are seeing that are in the foster home and the folks here in Salem that are working to put together the corrective action plans. Again, immediate suspension is not something we would want to do unless absolutely warranted, because we have to immediately move up to five people from that foster home and find new placements for them right away. And that can be incredibly traumatic for them, for their family. But we have had 20 situations or 19 situations in the past year where we believe that it was warranted. The situations were so grave that we did not feel that residents were safe in that environment for even another day. And so we've had to go in and immediately suspend. The first couple of times we did this, we did not do it well. And so we had to implement a policy and a procedure to make sure that we did as much pre-planning as possible before we go in, line up transportation, try to see who might have vacancies, get the phone numbers of family ready. And so we have a checklist system now of the things that our staff are required to do before we go in and immediately suspend. So I'll close today by saying that we are more committed as a program than ever to ensuring the safety of the individuals that we serve, but we also firmly believe in consumer choice and upholding dignity and helping people maintain their independence as they age. And I'm really honored to work with such a team of dedicated staff and our director. I feel confident in them, and I know that they have incredibly hard jobs. They see a lot of sad situations, and they encounter difficult cases every day, and they do it with grace and ease. Tomorrow, I'll cover the remaining parts of our program, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much. All right. Reminder, we will be back in room 170 tomorrow for one more day, and then we'll go back to hearing room F on Monday. And I think with that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned.